Blog Talk Radio.
Fasten your seatbelts. The foremost authority on 9/11, the best-selling author of Methodical Illusion, and a researcher extraordinaire, Rebecca Roth is about to step up to the microphone and launch into Reality Check, where the light will shine brightly upon the truth.
Welcome to the Rebecca Roth Show. This is definitely going to be a fasten your seatbelt kind of show because we're going to talk about Flight 93 and all of the phone calls associated with that. And as you think back on 9/11, most of the impressions that the American people had about Flight 93, other than the visual images of airplanes flying into the towers, were really the phone calls associated with Flight 93 because there were so many of them. When you look at the other flight that we've done and the, you know, two or three phone calls on those flights, it paled in comparison to what Flight 93 was. So, without further ado, I give you Miss Rebecca Roth.
Well, thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure, Ramjet, to hook up with you and do another show. You know, first off, I want to just kind of remind people, if you're new and you haven't listened to our previous shows, we first started out talking about the FAA hijack protocol called the Common Strategy that was in place for many, many years, actually about 30, before 9/11. It was a step-by-step protocol that all the flight attendants and pilots were taught. It was not followed that day, and that's one of the things that kind of caught my attention. Once I discovered that several of the hijackers were in fact still alive. Now, we're talking about Flight 93. Everyone knows that as Shanksville. I think everyone knows that as the airplane that disappeared into a ditch, and it kind of looked like a star formation, so you could kind of see the tail went here and the wings went here. And we were supposed to believe that a 757, it's a gigantic airplane, I mean, it's the size of a 707, that it just disappeared into the dirt. There was never any titanium engine parts or no landing gear, no tires, no luggage, no pods underneath the cargo area. There are all those metal pods where we fill in your luggage and we fill in mail, and none of it was found except for one of the hijackers' passports. And then later on, I think they claimed that they found a red bandana that he was wearing. Are supposedly wearing. But we know now from those of you who have come along with us what happened, and what happened to me as a flight attendant when I realized that I discovered that at least six of the hijackers were still alive, and it was reported on BBC about 10 days after 9/11. And I didn't discover that till about 8 years after 9/11. So when I saw that hijackers were still alive, and I started to look at this, I started to look at the anomalies and the fact that the crew members didn't follow the FAA protocols. Now, on Flight 93, we still have alive to this day a gentleman by the name of Sayed Al-Ghamdi, and he was 5'9". He is still alive. We have another character, very interesting connection. I don't know if he's still alive, but there's an interesting connection to Israel with this one. Ziad Jarrah, and he was the tallest of all of the hijackers. He was 5'11". He weighed almost 180 pounds. And several years after 9/11, he had an uncle very close to him, and I believe it was in Lebanon, that was arrested. And I read the article, and it just shocked me, because what are the chances? Again, here's another coinkydink, because I don't believe in coincidences anymore. His uncle, who was very close to his family, was arrested for being a Mossad agent. Another interesting connection to Israel. We've found those on each of the three flights that we've talked about before. There's another gentleman who's 5'7". His name was Ahmed Al-Nami, and he's also still alive. There's another guy who was a hijacker supposedly on this flight, another gentleman, 5'7". And his name was also Ahmed Al-Haznawi. And we don't know about him. He could be a completely fictitious character for all we know. But there are four hijackers that we know that the official story claims. And we do know that three of the four are in fact still alive, which I think makes it really interesting because we have an airplane that showed no crash site, a 757 that made a divot, a little ditch, and nothing came out of it except when I think he was a Saudi Arabian passport, and I think it was actually Ziad Jarrah's passport.
Didn't, as time went on, didn't they kind of salt a few things into there that...
That's true.
You know, maybe body parts.
Yeah, they later on, they salted the flight attendant Cece Lyle's purse and some old identification. They questioned how they ever found it because she was like before she got married and, you know, like an old driver's license with her other name on it and some things like that, but her, like her flight purse.
Stuff that she might have had in her
yeah,
purse.
Yeah, sure.
You know,
exactly.
So they,
in her
they certainly had mm-hmm. access to
mm-hmm.
that stuff.
Sure, they did.
And so they just salted it
salted
where they needed
it. Later.
To salt.
Yeah, that's true.
Why don't you, if you would, just for maybe for my benefit, is just kind of give us an idea of what Flight 93 did or where it was, where it took off from, where it was supposed to be going, and.
Well, I'm going to try to cover this. One's kind of complicated, so you kind of may just get a piece of paper and a pencil, and you want to doodle through this one because I'm going to give you some altitudes and attitudes of the aircraft while the phone calls are being made because this is how you have to put it together. But, you know, when I saw that Thomas Keene, who was the chairman of the 9/11 Commission, had written in his book, along with Lee Hamilton, who was the vice chair, that they were so frustrated with the repeated misstatements by the Pentagon and the FAA that the 9/11 Commission actually considered an investigation into possible deception. And I think that's where I got the title for a book, too.
Yeah, I don't think they considered it too hard, but
yeah.
they were bent out of shape
yes.
about
well,
it.
Well, in other words, what they're saying, and they said this in their book they published in 2006, what they were saying, and this is called Without Precedent, the Inside Story of the 9/11 Commission, written by Thomas Keene. And what they were basically saying in there was kind of CYA, that they knew they were being lied to. And here's who they were being lied to, the military via the Pentagon and the FAA. And when I saw that, I thought, well, then if they think the FAA's lying, well, let me take a real close look at what the FAA was putting out about this information. So this is the one that really, if they hadn't done this, now this flight left 41 minutes late. Remember, it was stuck in traffic at Newark. At morning traffic, the morning push at all three of the New York airports can be a long wait. 40 minutes is not atypical. I mean, it's very common, even in good weather, which we had that day, a really clear weather.
And on a transcontinental flight, generally you can make up a good portion of that that time. And so I guess they don't worry about it if it takes off 40 minutes late,
right.
Typically speaking.
Well, what happens when you schedule an airline schedule? And they know they're pushing out at the peak traffic hours. They pad the flight time. So they give you, if they say it's a 6.5 hour flight, they put that average of, say, 30 minutes on the ground in there. They kind of just made it part of the flight time because it just is always going to happen. It's not really that uncommon. But, you know, if you weren't in the airline and you were planning this, there's two things I saw right away. One, because I've been told that there were other airplanes that had supposed hijacked crews on board, they were 757s, and I'm here to tell you that the 757 was sort of notorious. I flew them periodically, and I commuted on them. So that means I flew on them to get to work. So I can tell you, they have hydraulic problems quite often, and those were usually half-hour, 45-minute delays often. So that would make my commuting home a real long trip, or to get to work kind of dicey sometimes because I was going to come in real late. So I always thought that was kind of strange that they picked the 757 because hydraulic mechanical would often happen right when we get everything ready to go. All the passengers are on, all the luggage is in, all the meals are on, the galleys are full, and we shut the door and the pilots go to turn on the key and crank it over, and all of a sudden a hydraulic leak light shows up in the cockpit. So oftentimes you'll see that's one of those delays where everybody's on board, we don't know how long it's going to take, and it's not really long enough to let you off the plane, but so that was really, to me, quite common to have happen. So, well, the interesting thing about Flight 93, I don't know, there's so many anomalies. You can write these down because there's a lot of them. That's why I thought we might have to do two shows. Interesting thing about this flight is that they had left around 40. And they weren't hijacked, supposedly, until 9:28. But 1 minute prior to being officially hijacked, according to the FAA, a passenger from first class named Tom Burnett, he called his wife in California. And I'm going to read some of this to you. I don't have it totally all memorized because this is just so fascinating to me because she was a retired flight attendant. And he calls her up, and according to this, I'm reading out of a historycommons.org, or this is from the Terror Timeline book also, pretty much word for word. The Terror Timeline changed things a little bit, but this is just a printout from when I first started doing this, probably a date on here. But she told the FBI, she was in San Ramon, California, and she looks at her caller ID. Remember, we had in our home phones, a lot of us don't have a home phone now, but we had those little boxes and the little thing on the phone that said what number it was. And on her caller ID, she looks, and she recognizes the number as being that of Tom's cell phone. All righty. Well, let's take a look at the National Transportation Safety Board right here and now. And here, lo and behold, I have charted out on this accident report. That plane was 35,000 feet. Let that sink in. She saw on her caller ID Tom's cell phone. Of course, so she says, well, she obviously had to have known he was scheduled to fly. Most people whose spouses are flying, we know what flight they're going to come home on. And
now, tell me again how many minutes it had been from the time it actually took off to the time it was hijacked. It seemed, just from what you said a few minutes ago, it seemed like it was like 30 minutes almost.
It was more than that. It took off at 8:40, and the first phone call came at 9:27.
So it was almost an hour.
Uh-huh.
So if that plane took off from Newark and it was heading to the West Coast, it would have been like over Kentucky or someplace close to that.
Yeah, quite a ways out.
Theoretically. Okay.
And so, interestingly enough, now being a flight attendant, of course she sees Tom's cell and knows that that's not going to work from an airplane. And so she says to him, "Are you okay?" And he says, "No, I'm not. I'm on an airplane that's been hijacked," he says. "They just knifed a guy." And then he adds that this person that was knifed was a passenger. Well, then she goes on to say he was actually sitting in the first class in 4B as in boy. And then she asks him, she says, "Well, are you in the air?" And of course she's still confused because cell phones don't work at altitude. He's at 35,000 feet. He's been in the air for nearly close to an hour, 40 minutes at least. Anyway, they're at cruise altitude for a good half an hour. And so she asks him, "Are you in the air?" And she says, "I didn't understand how he could be calling me on his cell phone because they don't work at altitude." "Yes, yes," he said, "just listen." Remember that? "Just listen." That's from Amy Sweeney, Flight 11. She said to her boss, this is one of the things from Methodical Illusion, "Listen and listen to me good." So I found that really interesting that he said, "Just listen." And then he tells her as if she didn't already know. And as a flight attendant, I'm here to tell you, if your kids or your spouse are flying, you know exactly what flight they're on and when they're going to land. She was probably picking him up at the airport. And so he says to her, "Oh, yes, yes, just listen. Our airplane has been hijacked. It's United Flight 93 from Newark to San Francisco. We are in the air." Hello, there it is again. "We are in the air. A hijacking only takes place in the air." That is a redundancy that almost every phone caller made. And so that's one of those things I started seeing these red flags, and I started putting all of the phrases of all of the people that made these phone calls from all of the flights, and one of the most common things said was, "We're up in the air," or "We're in the air." "Our airplane has been hijacked," he tells her. "We're up in the air." "One of them has a gun, and they're telling us there's a bomb on board. Now, Tom Burnett calls her four times from the airplane. Well, it would be a miracle of God if you could get one phone call in. I'm telling you, it's impossible. So there's no way that you would hang up, I'm going to call you back, and you'd have a chance in hell of getting another call made on a cell phone. It's impossible. And so he calls her, and then he just tells her that they have a gun and that there's all that stuff. So he says to her, I'll call you back, and then he hangs up. Well, what would make you think you could call somebody back if you just had a miracle of all miracles that you could make a cell phone call from 35,000 feet? He was a businessman. He traveled. He knew his phone didn't work. And so did she. She was the flight attendant. But the thing I found really interesting is that he knew 1 minute before the pilots were officially hijacked, and they heard actually a commotion, they claimed, in the cockpit, and the pilots said it sounded like Mayday, Mayday, and somebody scuffling around. Well, if somebody really came into the cockpit, somebody would scuffle around. It would be one of the pilots, and he would be grabbing the crash axe and would be smacking whoever that was over the head. So that's just kind of a weird thing. So the official story, they have this sort of Mayday, Mayday thing, but 1 minute prior, this guy in 4B knew the plane was being hijacked. He knew there was a gun on board, and he knew there was a bomb because what? The hijackers told him? I mean, go figure. I mean, you have to think about these because how would he have known?
Now, if he was in 4B, he could have seen anybody that would have burst into the cockpit.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like he was back on row 27C like some of the flight attendants in the previous flights that, you know, are a football field and a half away from, you know, what it was that is actually going on. So he would have known this.
That's right.
And yet he doesn't say anything about it.
He never said how. Again, as we told him, the other three flights, how did a hijacker get into the cockpit was the most important thing that anyone could have said. Now, there were five flight attendants on the 757. And we don't know that one of them was injured or stabbed or shot or anything else. There's no explanation why that first class flight attendant didn't do anything, because there's nothing that says anything happened to her or him. Anyway, I found it really interesting, being a flight attendant. We talked about the common strategy. So if you haven't heard that show, go back and listen to it. Because when Tom calls her and he tells her this, all of this information, she tells him word for word the common strategy. This is what the flight attendants should have all been doing. She said, Tom, sit down and do not draw attention to yourself.
As in, get off the damn phone.
Don't be a hero. And this is exactly what every flight attendant should have done, except if there were a flight attendant that a hijacker was specifically dealing with. If a hijacker had a weapon and had it in your belly, or had a gun to your throat or something like that, or a knife to your throat, you would be the one, you get to be with that hijacker. Everyone else is to sit down and not draw attention to themselves. We would put a blanket over our uniform, put somebody else's coat on, take our names and name tags and wings off, pretend we're asleep, but do not draw attention to yourself. And we would never sit on the phone call like those two flight attendants did on Flight 11 for 27 minutes. Absolutely not. Because if there really was a hijacker on board, and they saw you with a cell phone or an air phone or any kind of phone to your ear, they would be certain that their plan was going to just to be skywashed, because you're telling somebody on the ground what's going on, and they're not going to be successful, so you would probably be killed. So, of course, we would never sit with a phone. These are the things, once I got out of the emotion part. But Flight 93 was all set up for the emotions, so to grab every American by the heartstrings, because that's what phone calls did. Even though there are some huge, huge, huge anomalies here. I mean, absolutely incredible anomalies. So, anyway, we had Tom Burnett. I got to check my notes here a second. So Tom Burnett calls in, and he calls over this period of time. Now, the aircraft is flying 35,000 feet, and when Tom makes his phone call, somehow, according to the National Transportation Safety Board, The aircraft goes up to 40,000 feet, goes up 5,000 feet. Well, you would know that on a 757. You would know it's moving up over, you know, a five-minute period, up 5,000 feet. So they're up to 42,000 feet now. And Jeremy Glick calls his wife. Now, this is kind of an interesting character. At 9:37, the aircraft now is just about 40,000 feet, going up to 42. Jeremy Glick starts talking to his wife on the phone. Now, he tells his wife some things, too. Let's see if I can find his details here, because he has an interesting thing. He says to his wife that there are, let's see, here it says, there are three hijackers. Okay, remember I told you there was four. I don't remember what the official story is, probably five. But he tells them their hijackers are of Middle Eastern and they're Iranian looking. Now, how would he know that? I have Iranian friends that don't look any different than an Italian or Hispanic or Mexican. So I'm not sure how Jeremy Glick did. But just so you know, Jeremy Glick, he's an interesting character, and he's worked, has some interesting work experience as well. But he was a Jewish boy as well. Not only was he a Jewish boy, but he was a black belt in judo, 6'2", 225 pounds. And so what did he decide to do? Now, Jeremy Glick's sitting at row 11, and he calls his wife, and he tells him that they are Iranian-looking, Middle Eastern, red headbands on. They stood up, and they yelled, and they ran right into the cockpit. I guess they just kind of whoop right in there.
Now, would row 11 be first class?
No.
Typically?
No.
So he's behind the, what do you call
it? Bulkhead and
bulkhead,
the curtain.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so how he would have seen this, I don't know. Because the hijackers were all seated in first class, supposedly. So he tells this story, and then he hangs on the phone with his wife, supposedly. Now, there's two short stories here, because, you know, 9-11, they've done this a lot. So he says that he thinks he sees a bomb, and they have a box with something red wrapped around it. And his family right away calls 911 and lets people on the ground know that he's in this hijacking. He's on the phone, and his airplane, he's on the phone now until the end, until, say, let's say, 10 o'clock, right? So it starts at 9:37. So for about 20 minutes, he's on the phone. He never mentions in anything that I've ever read about his conversations with his wife, which isn't a lot of details, but let me tell you what happens in the side of his phone calls. Because when he goes talking to them, he's at 40,000 feet. When he's done talking to them, he's at 1,000 feet, and he never mentioned the word descent or landing or coming down or coming out of the sky. And during that time, this aircraft, according to the FAA and the National Transportation Safety Board, was actually coming out of the sky between 6 and 10,000 feet per minute. So this is like an emergency rapid descent that you would have a hard time holding a telephone, even an airphone that's got a string hooked to it. You would have a hard time doing anything, fighting the G-forces that you'd be under going down. Not only that, but this airplane is a long and skinny airplane. And when you go through an emergency, like a decompression, and you've got to get down real quickly to below 10,000 feet, and you come down maybe 6,000 feet a minute, or, you know, somewhere between 4 and 6,000 feet a minute, it's scary. What happens, the airplane literally shakes when you start descending like that. It's not normal. You would know something really bad and serious and scary is happening. He never says anything, but his wife says stuff like, you know, there was no panic, and there was no sound of stress or distress in and around him. But he went from 40,000 feet down to 1,000 feet without ever saying, we're landing somewhere, or we're on a rapid descent, or we're going to crash.
So typically she would have heard people screaming in
the background.
Because when you're coming down that fast, people get nervous, they get scared, and they say things and yell things
that they ordinarily wouldn't
do on a flight.
Oh, yeah. Not only that, but it's kind of interesting that around where he was sitting is where all the people were making these phone calls. Like almost everyone from row 11 and 12 made phone calls, interestingly enough. And so it's really fascinating because one of the women that called, she never mentioned hijackers. She said they are treating us very kindly. And then I believe she's the same woman who just told her family, and I think this was on a recording, if I remember correctly, how to get to her safe, where the key to her safe was or the combination to her safe. She knew that she was going to be killed, and she never called them hijackers. She just referred to them as they. She obviously was showing signs of the Stockholm Syndrome, and I have to look here. She made her phone call. Well, let's see if I can find a kind of an exact time. She made her phone call probably around 9:50 or so. Now, this airplane crashed somewhere between 10:03 and 10:10. I mean, that's how many. There's probably about 8 different crash times for this plane. And that's impossible as well. So you know they're making up a story when they can't get their facts straight, especially with an airplane crash, because you know when you're... I mean, it's just ridiculous. They claimed for years they didn't get the black box out of this thing. And we just saw a plane crash. Now, it's a Fly Dubai aircraft that crashed in Rostov on the Don in Russia. And it came out of the sky. I watched it. It's on a security video. I mean, you can look this up on the internet. Fly Dubai is the name of the airline. And it was, I believe, a 737, much smaller aircraft, 800 series, I think it was. And quite a bit smaller than the 757, but it came out of the sky. You can see it. I mean, you can see it coming down like it looks like a comet, as fast as you'd see a comet or a shooting star kind of comes down. Bright light, it crashes, and you'll see the rescue people are about knee-deep in parts of airplanes. There's large chunks of the windows, and you just see all the stuff that you never saw at Shanksville. And this is one of the airplanes on 9/11. That I think when, after I was on Coast to Coast AM, that I was in contact with so many people, they always said to me, there were two problems with 9/11. I never believed a plane crashed in Shanksville. There was no crash site there. And this is true. I saw the same thing. And then the Pentagon. And so we talked about the Pentagon last week. So none of these people that made these phone calls mentioned this rapid descent, which I found really kind of interesting, because around close to 10 o'clock, let's say 9:57, 9:58, somewhere in there, Cece Lyles called in, I believe, the first time. She called again and left a message the first time. I think it was at 9:47. Okay, so we had 10 minutes of this rapid descent.
And Cece Lyles was a flight attendant.
She was a flight attendant. And so when she makes that first phone call, the aircraft here is at 19,000 feet. They've just come out of the sky from 42,000 to 19,000. She leaves a message to say goodbye to her husband and her kids on her home recorder because he was a police officer and he worked nights, and so he didn't pick up the phone. She was very calm, and you can hear this. It's on Wikipedia. Hey babe, we've been hijacked, and there's like three hijackers, and I just want to say I love you, and tell the kids I love them, and everything's good. Again, a flight attendant would never phone home. We have phone numbers that are specific to deal with an emergency. So if you could get on, let's say an airphone, because the cell phone is not going to work, but let's say you had an airphone that you could use, you would call crew scheduling or a secure line with your company, and we know them. We know which ones they are. We know which ones we'd call. And probably most flight attendants would call because we have the crew scheduling number in our heads pretty much. So that's the number we would probably call to get in to talk to someone, anyone. We surely would never, ever, ever phone our mom and dad or our spouse. And the two flight attendants that called out, Sandy Bradshaw was the other one, and she called out around, I believe it was 9:58 or so, just maybe 5 minutes, 3 minutes or so, before the plane supposedly flipped upside down, and they took the beverage cart and tried to crash through the cockpit door, all the passengers.
I want to go back to Cece Lyles for just a second, because isn't she the one on the Wikipedia voice wave that's on there? Isn't she the one that if you listen to it at the end, it says, you did great?
That's right. Some people like to say she's saying it's a frame, but if you listen to it very, very carefully, she does. It's some other woman that you can hear her voice say, "You did great," and telling this flight attendant when she made that phone call to say goodbye to her family that she did great in doing so. She did a good job. And so, yeah, I don't know why people want to say that. But
I mean, for me, that really was a clincher in terms of this whole thing was a crock, because, you know, it's obvious when you listen to that, and we've heard various versions of it slowed down, mm-hmm. and you can tell that it's a different voice that's saying that. Even if they were saying the cornflakes are nice, mm-hmm. you wouldn't, you know, the fact that it's a different voice and a different person leads you to believe that, you know, there was somebody standing over her monitoring what it was she was saying, and they wanted her to call home knowing that she could leave a voice message because they wanted that voice message to be mm-hmm. for time and eternity for everybody to listen to and
yeah.
to, you know, pull at the heartstrings.
Exactly.
And that makes me angry.
Well, here's another thing that's another anomaly about this flight. We have a guy who's named Mark Bingham, and everybody knows this guy because he's the one who called his mother and said, "Hi, Mom, this is Mark Bingham." He used his first and last name. Now, the interesting thing to me that really struck me about this, and I didn't realize this at the time, but apparently his mother had been a flight attendant as well. And I believe she was retired at this time, but he says to her, "I'm on a flight from Newark to San Francisco, and there are three guys who have taken over the plane, and they say they have a bomb." And he says, "I'm in the air." There it is again. "I'm in the air." "Okay. I'm calling you from the air phone," he tells her. "I'm calling you from the plane. We've been taken over. There are three men that say they have a bomb." Okay. Well, here's an interesting little tidbit about Mark Bingham. Here we had Jeremy Glick, the black belt karate judo champion over there, 6'2". Well, we have Jeremy Glick here, and he was either 6'2 or 6'4, 225 pounds thereabouts. He was a rugby champion and still actively playing rugby in San Francisco in the Bay Area.
Now, it's Mark Bingham that was the rugby player?
Yes.
Okay, I just wanted to correct
yes,
you.
Yes, Mark Bingham played rugby, 6'2", 225. So we got two big guys here that called their mommy or their wife to tell them, instead of getting up. And again, let me just tell you, now they both said three hijackers. But according to the official story, I've got a piece of paper here that at least four of them were claimed to be on there. So maybe the three that are still alive are the ones that were really on there. We have Ziad Jarrah, who was supposedly the pilot, according to the official story, 5'11". We have Ahmed Al-Nami, who was alive still to this day. He's 5'7". And then we have Sayed Al-Ghamdi, who's still alive also from Flight 93, and he's 5'9". So we got these two big guys, right? But it gets better than that.
But, you know, before you go get there, the next time I call my mother, I'm going to use my first and my last name just to see how she reacts.
Yeah, how many people would do that?
You know, the listening audience, if you talk to your mother in the next week, use your first and your last name and see how she responds to that. She's going to say, "What?" Or something worse.
Well, there's another person who called out, and she called, let's see, around 9:40. So she's now about 10 minutes into the hijacking, maybe 12 minutes into the hijacking. And she says, "Honey, are you there? Jack, pick up the phone, sweetie." She leaves this message, I guess, on the recorder. And she goes, "Oh, okay, well, I just want to tell you I love you. We're having a little problem on the plane." Yeah, she continues, "I'm comfortable and I'm okay for now. Just a little problem. Just so I love you. Please tell my family I love them too. Bye-bye, honey." So now, this is kind of interesting, because then she passes the phone to another young gal, Elizabeth Waino, and she's supposedly sitting next to her, and she makes a phone call as well. Again, She didn't say a hijacker, did she? She just wanted to say goodbye, because the phone calls coming out of this were only to grab our heartstrings. This was the emotional grabber. This was the last one. And I do believe, in looking at this as much as I have, that somewhere around 10, I forget the exact time now, 10, maybe 10:10, somewhere in there, the Secret Service contacted CNN that morning, the Secret Service, and told them that a plane had crashed into Camp David. But nothing had crashed into Camp David. And also, you'll remember that the Sears Tower was evacuated that morning, and then we had Building 7 that wasn't hit by anything, and so we got two planes hitting two buildings and three buildings fall down at the World Trade Center, right? So we have something was supposed to look like it was hitting Building 7. We have something that was supposed to look like it hit Sears Tower, possibly, and quite possibly Camp David, because nothing ever happened there. Which I found really interesting that the Secret Service, that should know whether a plane landed or not in Camp David, called CNN to tell them that a plane had crashed into Camp David. So maybe they knew the scenario. Could it have been? Now, people ask me a lot, what do you think about George Bush and the fact that he sat there reading that book for those children in the Florida elementary school? Well, I've known Secret Service guys, and if you just study up a little bit, maybe just even a Google search on this. Secret Service guys do one thing. They keep the President of the United States safe. They'll take a bullet for him. Remember when someone shot at Ronald Reagan? So that's their job. Now, on 9/11, we had Bush sitting in an elementary school in Florida, and when the second tower was hit at 9 o'clock, he didn't leave that classroom until sometime around 9:30, 9:35. And so what does that tell you? It tells you the Secret Service must have known there was no worry about anything hitting the president in Florida, because they knew this wasn't a real terrorist attack. They knew what was going to happen. But they must have also been told of the scenario. Remember the scenario that we saw... Brian Sweeney from United 175. He told us that a group of passengers were talking about taking over the cockpit, taking it back from the hijackers. That's the scenario from this flight, Flight 93. That's also a scenario that flight attendants were taught and told to never, ever, ever allow passengers to get up and play hero. Because they don't know what we're trying to do. They don't know the name of the game. They don't know the step-by-step protocol that we knew. They don't know what the outcome we were striving for would be. And we can't trust people to get up and not know the code words, not know what we're going to do, not know what's supposed to be done, and be the hero and then, wet their pants at the end.
Well, more importantly, you don't know how whatever their reaction is going to be is going to interrupt what the pilot's doing.
Exactly.
It could be that the pilot is regaining control of an aircraft. They've actually used the crash axe, mm-hmm. and you've got people busting into a cockpit, which, as you all know, is a relatively mm-hmm. small area to begin with, and especially in the more modern planes. You're not going to get six or seven people in a cockpit.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're going to get to one of my favorites now. Let's roll.
We've got probably about 20 minutes left.
I want to get this whole thing in this 1 hour if I can.
All right.
But let's
then
roll.
Then let's roll.
Let's roll. Todd Beamer. Now, Todd Beamer, he worked for Oracle, and you'll remember that somehow the CEO of Oracle knew before anyone else that Todd Beamer did this let's roll thing, right? Like 12 or 14 hours before the airline made this public, somehow the president and CEO of Oracle, Todd's boss, his big boss, knew that Todd would play hero and use the words let's roll, because it wasn't made public by the FBI yet, which is another one of those weird anomalies on Flight 93. But it gets even weirder with Todd. Todd supposedly tries to call his wife at home, and the call doesn't go through. So he calls the GTE operator, and she offers to hook him up. That's what operators do. We used to call the operator to get a call put through. She offers to him to let me connect you with your wife. He says no. He doesn't want to talk to her. He doesn't want to upset her. Well, he knows he's in this hijacked plane, right, supposedly. So, and she's going to be upset when she finds this out, right? Anyway, so yeah, he just says, no, I don't want to talk to her. He says the Lord's Prayer or Psalms or something with this supposed GTE operator. He's on the phone. Now, Todd Beamer, he starts his phone call at 9:45. Okay, 9:45. Remember that this plane started coming out of the sky about 9:40, and I know it was coming on that rapid descent. So at a 9:45, let me tell you where it was about maybe 15,000 feet. Again, he doesn't tell the operator the plane is coming out of the sky. We're landing. I don't know where we're at. He just kind of wants to pray with her. Now, he's on the phone from 9:45. Jeremy Glick is on the phone from 9:37. Tom Burnett, he started calling in at 9:27, and he made four different phone calls throughout this period of time. And then we had Mark Bingham. And let me tell you what time he called, because it's important that you know this, because when we put this last piece of the puzzle together, at 9:42, Mark Bingham's on the phone. He talks to his mom for a few minutes. And Todd Beamer tells the GTE operator that a group of passengers are going to take over the cockpit. And that's how the let's roll thing, he leaves the phone open. He doesn't hang up. She supposedly hears him say, let's roll. And at that time, it's around 9:57, 58. At that time, Sandy Bradshaw, another flight attendant, calls her husband, who was a pilot for U.S. Airways, I believe it was. And she says, hey, have you heard? We've been hijacked. Now there's like three or four guys, and we've been hijacked. And she sounds like a cheerleader. And she's, you know, oh, but we're gonna take over. They're gonna take over the passengers. They're gonna take over the cockpit. Well, this is like the airplane at this point, according to the National Transportation and Safety Board, is coming out of the sky at more than a 40-degree angle and upside down. How do you think they were gonna get a beverage cart or a meal cart in that aisle coming out of the? Now, if you've just been in some light turbulence with a beverage cart anywhere near you, you're gonna. Remember this. Think about this. Flight attendants that are listening to this, I know you're laughing. 40-degree angle coming out of the sky, 6 to 10,000 feet a minute, and flipping that plane, supposedly according to the National Transportation Safety Board, upside down, because that's how it hit the ground. That's why it went in and disappeared. That's what they said. Kind of flipped right in upside down. That the passengers... Now, another thing interesting. We have Tom Burnett, Jeremy Glick, Mark Bingham, and Todd Beamer. And every one of them is either 6'2", 6'3", or 6'4", between 225 and 235 pounds. All played rugby, professional sports, judo champion. They all were aggressive. As a matter of fact, Mark Bingham, just months before, had fought off an armed mugger in the city of San Francisco, or the Bay Area somewhere, and with his bare hands. And the guy had a gun. So all of these guys were what they were referred to as aggressively competitive. All of them. Not one of them was talking to each other. So there was no plan to take over the cockpit, because all of these men were on the phone to someone else during this time where they would have been planning to take over the cockpit. They were all sitting in different rows, way away from each other, on different phone calls to different people. So it's impossible that a let's roll scenario is a total joke, and it's a lie, and it's a charade. And I guess they just wanted you. How did Todd Beamer, the president of Oracle, know this 14 hours before it was ever made public that Todd did the let's roll thing?
And Todd didn't call him and tell him.
Well, here, let me tell you about Todd's cell phone. That leads me, that was a great segue into this. Okay, so we have Todd calling out, you know, he's supposedly calling on his GTE phone because he was talking to a GTE operator, praying with her up until he said, let's roll. And then somehow everybody knew the scenario was to take over the cockpit while that plane was upside down, coming out of the sky at a 40-degree angle or upside down. Okay, so that we can't believe anymore. We just have to let that one go. But here's the weird thing about it. He had a cell phone with him in his pocket, I guess. That cell phone, according to the 9/11 Commission, continued making phone calls, or that phone call, actually, I think it was, continued making phone calls until later on that day. That phone call went on for 3,925 seconds. That's an hour and 6 minutes after the crash. I'm not sure how that happened.
I need to get me one of those phones.
Now, you can just drop your cell phone on a on a granite countertop and you know better. Because we know that nothing survived in that ditch. No landing gear, no titanium jets. The jet thing, the size of that jet's probably somewhere between 8 and 9 feet in diameter. The jets are huge on a 757. You can Google them and look them up. So I find this really, really fascinating that in the Zachariah Massawi trial, they bring up this information that his phone call started just before 9:44 a.m., didn't hang up until 10:49. Now, how do you think that happened? But Todd also made, Todd's cell phone also made numerous phone calls that day as late as 8:58 p.m. on 9/11. Now, how does that happen? And the FBI has phone records in a PDF showing this.
That Shanksville hole was one magic
hole. It went all the way
hole.
To China. Got a new cell phone. So you can see what happened to me when I started to see through this stuff. And as a flight attendant, and these are my family. These are my coworkers. They're my family. I'm very much in connection now with several flight attendants from both airlines involved, even though I did not fly for them. And just talking with them and just talking them through, and after they read the methodical illusion and then the methodical deception, we usually get together and have a phone call. Because sometimes it takes that. To be able to come to grips with what we come to grips with as flight attendants and pursers and pilots, actually. The pilots, the same thing. It's very hard for us to realize what we have all put together now. Because, you see, there are so many impossibilities. Remember, earlier on a show, I said that after 9/11, I was usually at the boarding door, and every single man that had the guts and was, you know, had any kind of experience in the military or firefighters or police officers, state patrolmen, they would stop me and they would say, if anybody gives you any guff, anybody tries anything on this plane, you just let me know. I'm going to be an 18J. Here's my, they give me a little piece of paper with their seat number on it. And I got to thinking after that, well, why didn't that happen on 9/11? And then when I found out that all of these guys on Flight 93 were big enough to pick up those 5'7" hijackers and break them in half. I mean, we had practically a rugby team on board. So all we had, these guys, they played college football. One of them was a quarterback. They were all big men, very physically fit, and they were all roughly 30 to 33 years old in the prime. And that's actually the prime age for CIA. Just lo and behold, just a coincidence, I guess. Oh, no, we don't believe in those anymore. So these are kind of the things that I started to see, and then I realized, and I at this point when I started to look this closely, I hadn't figured out where the planes actually had gone. I was just looking at this, and I was just so confused that none of this made any sense.
Now, was it this plane that the passengers said that they wanted to get boiling water?
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that, because that's kind of goofy, too.
Well, this is the thing that was going on at the end when Cece Lyles and Sandy Bradshaw both called their husbands, breaking protocol again, two flight attendants, and I believe it was Sandy Bradshaw, told her husband that the passengers were going to take coffee pots of hot water and try to break into the cockpit. And between the two pilots on the floor is the flight computer.
But before you get to that, I just want to, in my mind, I'm envisioning people running with hot water while the plane is upside down.
Or even at a 40-degree angle, or even just coming out of the sky at 6,000 feet a minute in a rapid descent. It's hard to stand up in turbulence. That's why we sit down. When you see us sit down, you better be strapped in, because we know, we can tell when it's getting to the point where we need to be strapped in. And if the pilots call back and say, the flight attendants, please be seated, and you're on that flight, you want to make sure your seatbelt's real good and tight and everything's underneath the seat in front of you, because it's going to hit the ceiling if it's not. Just chug your drink or you're going to wear it. But, you know, that's just the years of experience. After 30 years, you see that kind of stuff, and you get to the point where you can kind of feel that. So even to me, I'm thinking, wait a minute, even moderate to light turbulence, you wouldn't be taking a beverage or meal cart with hot water on the top into the cockpit to crash through the door, to break the door down. That's a real small cockpit. And there's a flight computer there that if you dumped water on it, you'd be crashing no matter what anyway. But then when you put it all together with the National Transportation Safety Board and what the FAA claimed, now we got to keep in mind, Thomas Keene told us the FAA was making misstatements. Well, I have accident reports from all four of the aircraft, and so I know they're all lies. I know they're all misstatements, because this is impossible, totally impossible. There were two men that were sitting in first class. There were only two guys that didn't make phone calls. I've read where it's just one, Mark Rothenberg, Jewish gentleman, who's a diamond salesman or something. And he was who I believe Tom Burnett suggested was stabbed. So much like Flight 11, where we had the Jewish IDF, Sayeret Metcalf, special agent, anti-hijacking hostage rescue specialist on board who was stabbed to death with a plastic box cutter. On this flight, we had another Jewish gentleman, Mark Rothenberg, who was just stabbed. That's all we know about him. And never to hear from him or anything else about him again. But yeah, I found it really interesting, because when Jeremy Glick's talking to his wife, he's on the phone for at least 20 minutes. They're coming out of the sky from 42,000 feet. If just come down to 19,000 feet or 10,000 feet, but they came down to hit the building, supposedly, 1,000 feet. He never said they were landing. He never said, hey, we're on a descent. We're on a rapid descent. We're on a scary as hell rapid descent, which is what he would have said. But he never said that. But she had said to the FBI and later made statements that the background, there was no screaming, no commotion whatsoever, and it was a very calm background the entire phone call. It was as if he was calling from the room next door to her.
Now, wasn't it her telephone equipment that the FBI confiscated? Or was that somebody
else? No, that
else?
Was Dina Burnett. Now, oh. Dina Burnett, when the FBI showed up in Ramona, California, she was the retired flight attendant, and she said he called from his cell phone, and I think by this time the FBI is starting to think, uh-oh, cell phones don't work at altitude, and they started to argue with her and about cell phones. And then when she said he said they had a gun, well, this was one thing they tried to cover up, but they also had a gun on Flight 11. According to documents I have in the Freedom of Information Act, that a passenger was shot on Flight 11. We haven't known that in the official story, but I've got official forms that have it written down that the FAA headquarters was notified. And we don't know who notified them, because neither one of the flight attendants that called down on Flight 11 said anyone was shot. But according to the FAA, there was a gun and someone was shot on Flight 11, American Airlines, also on this one. So when she tells the FBI, and of course the FBI doesn't want you to think that they let bombs, guns, mace, pepper spray, and knives and box cutters, all of which were illegal to bring on board the aircraft, through security and get through. Nobody got caught. So they argued with her and said, no, he couldn't have had a gun. They couldn't have seen a gun. The hijackers could not have had a gun. And she's like arguing with them. I think she wrote a book actually about it. She said, listen, Tom grew up with guns. He knows a gun when he sees a gun. And I thought that was really odd that the FBI started to tell people how, started to rearrange the story for them. No, it couldn't have been a gun. No, he couldn't have used a cell phone. And that sort of thing. So, you know, again, where... what was going on inside the aircraft, and this is where when I started to figure all of it out, is I made those charts with the National Transportation Safety Board and the FAA numbers, and the charts, and these are from the accident report, so this is the real deal. And when I started to put in the phone calls and who was making phone calls and what the plane was doing, I thought to myself, and we got two flight attendants at the end. At the end, that airplane wasn't 5,000 feet elevation when those two flight attendants called out to their spouses, breaking protocol. They should not have done that. But the airplane went from 42,000 feet down to about 5,000 feet. At the time, two flight attendants are phoning out to their husbands, and neither of them ever said anything about crashing. The one just said, the passengers are going to try to take over the cockpit with some hot water. And neither one of them said anything about a rapid descent or scary or anything like that. Again, they were all really calm, kind of like Betty Ong, who she just kept saying she was at her jump seat at 3R, which is a piece of information that nobody needed to know. But what we did need to know, what would have really worked for our future, is how did any hijacker ever get into any cockpit, and not one of the crew members, there were nearly 30 flight attendants, not one of them ever contacted anyone to tell them how it was done, which I found really unbelievable myself. Flight attendants are just all business when you put that uniform on. So to break protocol like that and call your spouse or your parents and stuff, I'm like, and then cell phones do not work at altitude, so most of these calls were made from cell phones.
The thing I also wanted to just stress is this plane took off from Newark, and those phone calls began right about the exact same time that the plane would have landed Westover.
Taking that plane up to Westover, if I remember correctly, they might have had a five-minute buffer before the phone call started making. But, you know, I always have said this, in a false flag situation or a make-believe, a hoax type of thing, what this was, it's the timeline. And we blew the timeline when Tom Burnett called 1 minute before the pilots knew there was a hijacking that a passenger would know. That's impossible. And so that was the first real clinker on this one. And the fact that, you know, Todd Beamer didn't want to talk to his wife, that's just hard to swallow. And maybe his wife could tell he was lying, so he'd rather just make that phone call with the operator. But the fact that all of the guys in the let's roll scenario that were going to take the beverage or meal cart and the hot water into the cockpit, that there was no timing. There was no time for timing. They were all four on different phone calls in different rows talking to different people up until the minute Todd Beamer yelled, "Let's roll." Now, who would know what that meant? They had no timing. They had no planning. They weren't even sitting together. They didn't know each other. But they were all 6'2" to 6'4", and they could have really just taken the hijackers out that were standing in the aisle. But there were none. There were none. And so that's why the scenario, the details, aren't working. The flight attendants say three, some say four, some say five hijackers. On each one of these flights, there was never anything that was the accurate information. Remember flight 11, Betty Ong and Amy Sweeney were saying they were sitting in two different locations. Amy Sweeney said they were both sitting in the second to the last row in coach together. And Betty Ong said she was sitting in her jump seat at 3R. It has to be one or the other. Can't be both. And so when you start to see stuff like that, knowing how important it is that all the details coming out of an airplane would be, one, going through the cockpit, but two, that would be the same information, how important that is. So. Anyway, I think we got through this flight. I think maybe we'd do one more. There's a bunch of anomalies. I might want to do one more show about these things that don't work, like what we were talking about with this, you know. I mean, how did Todd Beamer's phone keep making phone calls till 8:58 that night? His cell phone that was in his pocket. How did his boss know before the FBI let that Let's Roll story out? How would anybody know when he yelled, "Let's roll," what they were going to do? Because they didn't have any time to plan it. So we see stuff like that. And why did that gang of 6'4", 225 pounders not do something to those little 5'7" hijackers?
Anyway, this has been the last 4 weeks we've talked about these phone calls. And I think Rebecca's done a remarkable job of expressing exactly what happened and how it worked, why things didn't work. And if you've had a chance to listen to these, I hope you've archived them so that you can refer back to them from time to time. Feel free to share them on any media that you have. This has just been an excellent opportunity for Rebecca to, you know, tell what she knows and to express her research. Again, she's working on her book. She's a little bit behind because she's been sick, but she's working feverishly, and that pretty much wraps up this little series on phone calls.
Yes, and thank you for joining us, and just contact me in the description box. I'll put all my websites if you want to email me. If you're a flight attendant, you have some questions or something you want to offer, you know, please contact me on my email. There's a button off every web page I have. So thank you very much for joining us. We hope you've enjoyed your flight, and have a safe journey home.